This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Washington lobbyists and the business of government. Hello again, I'm Warren Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The Jack Abramoff scandal has exposed how the growth of lobbying has made Washington a profit center for American corporations. $2 to $6 billion a year are being spent on influence peddling, which means opportunities for both legal profit-making and widespread corruption. On To the Point, we'll hear how the system works and how it's exploded out of control. Do ordinary citizens have a chance of being heard by their elected officials? What does it mean for America's role as a model democracy? On Reporter's Notebook later on, Ariel Sharon and Israel's political future. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. The Jack Abramoff scandal reveals that influence peddling in Washington is a growth industry worth $2 to $6 billion a year. On To the Point, we'll talk with lobbyists and others about how it works and how public confidence in American democracy might be restored. On Reporter's Notebook, Ariel Sharon is in grave condition. We'll hear what that could mean for Israeli politics and the peace process in the Middle East. First, this news update. In Iraq, suicide bombings killed at least 100 people today as President Bush met in the White House with former secretaries of state and defense.
Not everybody around this table agreed with my decision to go into Iraq, and I fully understand that. But these are good, solid Americans who understand that we've got to succeed now that we're there. And I'm most grateful for the suggestions that have been given.
Some of those who were attending the meeting today include the former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, former Defense Secretaries William Cohen and William Perry, all those in the Clinton administration. Perry, an advisor to John Kerry in last year's campaign. Richard Wolff is senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Richard, always good to have you with us.
Warren, good to be with you again.
The president is not known as a person who suffers his critics gladly. Does this suggest some new direction in the White House?
Well, it does. Now, it seems to be a question of presentation more than substance, in the sense that this isn't a great forum to give advice, but it still is significant. It's an extraordinary sight seeing all of these wise old men and women there in front of him. And it does mark a certain kind of outreach that is very much in tune with the president's new tone on Iraq, one where he's conceding mistakes and looking for new ideas.
We heard briefly from the president. Some of the former officials spoke out as well. Did any of them have anything substantive to say? Did they, for example, criticize him to his face?
Well, there was apparently some mild criticism. Former Secretary of State Larry Eagleburger, who worked for the president's father, and has been very critical in public. He said there was some critical comments, but they were mild. People tended to tone things down in front of the president. And he said for the most part, these comments focused on presentational questions, that the president needed to talk to the American people more. You know, it's funny because we've heard similar things from members of Congress who privately or semi-privately to reporters will say, you know, the president needs to do this, this, and that. But when they get face-to-face with the president, they tend to confine their comments to presentational or communications questions.
Something about the White House, I guess, and the austere nature of that office that makes people somewhat less forthcoming than they might be otherwise. We're talking with Richard Wolff, who's senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. So it doesn't appear then that there's going to be any substantial policy change out of this. How does it relate to all the speeches the president has been making in recent weeks?
Well, it is very much of a piece with that. You know, the president is trying to do two things. First of all, he's saying, I have a strategy on Iraq to counter the notion that has come across pretty clearly in the polls that people don't think there is an effective strategy in Iraq. So in simply talking about strategy publicly and with these groups, he's leaving the impression that he has a plan. And secondly, there is this idea reported by us, among other people, that the president is in something of a bubble, as all presidents are, but this one in particular. And this kind of event with former officials from other administrations, obviously including Democratic administrations, this is in some ways an effort to counter that image that the president isn't receiving varied advice and isn't in tune with new ideas.
Cover of your magazine, of course, showed the president in a bubble very, very recently. He says, of course, that he has a dual-track policy, a part of its politics, part of its the security situation. Would it appear that he will be consulting with these former secretaries of state and defense in the future?
You know, not directly. I wouldn't expect that. But it's true well before now that the secretaries of defense and state have been in regular contact with some of these former, with their predecessors. That's not surprising. We've seen McNamara do events with Don Rumsfeld at the Pentagon. We know that Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice talks to Madeleine Albright and others, and Colin Powell, of course, people who may not see eye to eye on current policy, but there is a certain sense, like former presidents and current presidents, that they're in something of an exclusive club. Very few people know the kind of pressures they're under, and they do try and share experiences with one another.
These are not loose cannons.
These are not loose cannons, even when they come from a radically different political perspective. You know, there is a certain sympathy and empathy there, and I think the current holders, office holders, like to feel that there is life outside the office.
Would the White House like to think that by doing this in such a public way, they're neutralizing people who could potentially be very effective critics?
Yeah, that is definitely part of it. And that's smart politics, to draw in credible voices and make them feel like they're being consulted and valued. You know, it's also true of former President Clinton, who noticeably toned down his concerns about administration policy after going into the White House. It does have a sort of, if not an intimidating effect, certainly a neutralizing effect in terms of public criticism.
All right. We will follow, of course, to see what happens next. Meantime, Richard Wolff, always good to talk to you.
Anytime.
Senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. In a moment, Washington lobbyists and the business of government on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Lobbying is a growth industry that's made Washington a profit center for American corporations. Between $2 and $6 billion a year are being spent on Capitol Hill by corporate clients who often hire former members of Congress, their staffs, and even their families. Jack Abramoff has become the symbol of a system that is out of control. That's according to the Washington Post in an article co-authored by Jeffrey Birnbaum. His books include The Money Men and The Lobbyists, How Influence Peddlers Work Their Way in Washington. Jeffrey Birnbaum, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you mean by out of control? How do you measure that?
Well, it's hard to measure, but I think a system that is so lubricated with money and access as the current system, only one like that could produce as an outlier Jack Abramoff. If the system was pristine in any sort of way, then even someone who's operating on the margins wouldn't fall over into criminality, as Jack Abramoff clearly has.
You call him an outlier, but he was associated with some of the most powerful members of Congress.
Yes, he was very much part of the system and an important Republican lobbyist in town. But as we've now discovered, as he's pleaded guilty to doing things that very few lobbyists do, which is not really lobbying, but theft. I'm not saying that there are no others that do this, but very few I've ever encountered on the scale that Abramoff has. And he and his partner took tens of millions of dollars from Indian tribes who were their clients, and instead of doing lobbying services or anything close to that, actually pocketed the money. So they actually bilked their clients. So it's more a matter along the lines of fraud rather than lobbying, which is a legitimate profession that is envisioned in our Constitution. So there is a difference between Abramoff and the run-of-the-mill lobbyist.
A legitimate profession that you have described as now the subject of courses in college.
Yes, I actually teach in seminars that teach kids about lobbying. I talk about the press and lobbyists, but in any case, sure. Lobbying is a multi-billion-dollar industry, an influence industry that's based in the nation's capital, and every state's capital also has a lot of lobbyists. So, I'm sure there's almost nobody who's listening here that doesn't have at least one lobbyist or lobbying group that represents his or her interests in Washington. The question is, has the system gotten out of control in the sense that only those groups that have a tremendous amount of money and can pay the large amounts that are necessary to hire the best-connected lobbyists to do the sort of very expensive grassroots kind of lobbying, also known as AstroTurf, can only groups with lots and lots of money get their way in the nation's capital? And that, I'm afraid, is very close to the system that we now have.
To what extent is that related to the fact that the Republican Party, one single party, controls both houses of Congress and the White House?
It's hard to see the exact connection. Lobbyists are important fundraisers for politicians, and corporate lobbyists, which control a lot of money, in fact, most of the money that sloshes around here in Washington, give disproportionately to Republican candidates. And so to the extent that money wins elections, then I guess you can see some connection. But if you're talking about lobbying in general and the influence on Republicans in charge here, there are two more direct things that I would mention. One is that corporate lobbyists in particular and Republican lawmakers in general have a similar philosophy about government and business. That is, that government should be very light-handed and business should be given its head. And so that puts them essentially on the same team. But more importantly, and this comes to the question of the culture of Washington, whether it's gone too far, when Republicans took over the House of Representatives after 40 years in 1994, those lobbyists, mostly corporate lobbyists, who stood with them and helped support their campaigns to help bring them out of the wilderness, so to speak, were considered members of the same team, if you will, and the barriers between insiders and outsiders to government was broken down. That is a very dangerous barrier to disassemble, and the extent to which the two act as in unity rather than with some skepticism on the part of the government insiders, that often leads to the charges of corruption that we're seeing these days.
Lobbyists tend to be have offices, or have in the past at least, on K Street in Washington, and the process you're talking about was actually formalized by Tom DeLay when he was majority leader into the K Street Project. What was that?
Well, that was an effort by DeLay and his friends to force lobbying organizations, big trade associations that represent, for example, the electronics industry, force them to hire as their chief executives or as their top lobbyists Republicans only. Now, Democrats, when they were in charge of Congress, there was a more subtle kind of influence that made sure that the Democrats had those jobs. The K Street Project was actual pressure, and in one case, actually, fiddled around with some legislation to exert that pressure, and DeLay was admonished or warned for not to do that. But in any case, the K Street Project has been around now for 10 or 11 years and has been made systematic. There are meetings among lawmakers on Capitol Hill regularly scheduled where job postings for big-time lobbyists are passed around so that friends of the Republicans in the room or former Republican staffers might get to the head of the list to get those jobs. There's even a website, believe it or not, KStreetProject.com, that also spreads the news of K Street jobs that at least the formers of that, the founders of the K Street Project, hope will go to Republicans.
Jeffrey Birnbaum, again, reporter for The Washington Post, author of books about the influence of lobbying in Washington, D.C. Matt LaRocco is general manager of Fleischmann Hillard Government Relations, Washington-based subsidiary of Fleischmann Hillard International Communications. Matt LaRocco, welcome to you.
Yeah, thank you.
I think you could be described accurately as a big-time lobbyist. Your father is also involved in the Fleischmann Hillard, former congressman. Did you, in fact, benefit from the so-called K Street project?
No, we really didn't. First of all, our family wasn't working. Well, our family, Larry and I, were not working as part of that. We never felt the pressures of the K Street project, and we were never called upon to kind of be of service to that organization. So I would never, consider ourselves affiliated with the K Street project.
What about it? Was it, in fact, as Jeffrey Birnbaum suggests, skirting the limits of what ought to be appropriate in Washington?
Well, I mean, I would say yes, it is. It is and it was. When you're putting pressure on people to hire a certain affiliation as opposed to the person who has the highest qualification, then I think that you're going around certain, ethical standards that, frankly, that the city was founded on in the first place. So I think you need to be very careful about how those lines are drawn and when you cross them and obviously when you shouldn't. And in this circle, I don't see this as a linear process. I like what Jeff was talking about. I think this is more circuitous in the fact that the K Street Project is connected to certain members of Congress and they make sure that their folks are hired. They make sure that money flows in the right directions. And so this works in a process where everybody is benefiting from it.
Well, he also talked about how in this situation, lobbyists and Congress people come to regard themselves as being on the same team. He says that's a dangerous barrier that has been disassembled. Here are you with your father, a former member of Congress. What do you say about that?
Well, actually, could you repeat the question?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Is there a danger when lobbyists and Congress people regard themselves as being on the same team? Is that not something that is occurring in part because so many former congressmen like your father are lobbyists?
Well, I think that's true to a point. I was never a lobbyist when my father was a member of Congress. So, it doesn't really apply to the LaRoccos in particular. There are certain members that have, they're the family members who are lobbyists downtown. I can give you two examples. I'll give you bipartisan examples. Tom Daschle's wife, Linda Daschle, was a lobbyist, as well as Roy Blunt, Congressman Blunt, who's in leadership. His son is also a lobbyist, and so. I think it gets a little bit fuzzy in those situations where family members are lobbyists and obviously wield an enormous amount of influence and familial ties to a member who might feel just that natural pressure to give into whatever organization or whatever company that family member is representing. So I think it comes very dangerously close to not crossing an ethical boundary, but I think that members need to be very careful in showing how they support their family if they are lobbying and what processes they take.
Talking with Matt LaRocco, once again, general manager of Fleischmann Hillard Government Relations in Washington. Let's talk a bit about some of the high-profile examples of what are said to be abuses, the use of private jets, taking congresspeople on tours, which appear to be more for vacations than they really are for research into legislative details or realities. Have you engaged in those things? Have you flown people around on private jets?
We've taken staff for trips that the committees have paid for on private planes, but it's our policy never to put members of Congress, their staffs, our clients, and ourselves in a position that would conflict with the law. The times that has happened, that's never conflicted with the law. There are ethical standards in place. There are laws in place that say that staff can take these trips on private planes, but they have to pay for those trips, and the trip has to be paid for as a first-class plane ticket. So under that ethical standard, we have done that. But, it gets I think, a little fuzzy when we were taking trips to visit a factory that was useful to their committee. We were never taking members of Congress or staff to play golf in Scotland, for example. I don't think that's the appropriate way to use a private jet.
That practice and that rule in Congress, though, is criticized because often the value of travel on the private jet is much greater than the value of a first-class ticket, particularly if you're going someplace that the airlines don't fly.
Yeah, I don't write the laws. I just follow them.
Sure.
Yeah.
Would you look forward then to some changes in that law particularly? There's also a law that you can't accept a gift worth more than $50, and it's reported that the owner of a major basketball team recently reported that tickets to his skybox were worth $49.50.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tighten up on those rules? Would that be appropriate?
I do think it's appropriate. I would hate to see because what Jeff had mentioned before, and I agree with him, is that if Skybox tickets are only $49, then how far are we going to stretch this thing? And then once we stretch it to those limits, then what is a trip to Scotland? What is a trip anywhere overseas where the trip is purely for entertainment value as opposed to a site visit for informational value? Staff take trips pretty much strictly for informational value to find out more about what they're, working on in committee. When you go into and when you stretch these boundaries into a $49 basketball ticket, which is clearly worth more than that, then I think you're really getting into an area that you're going to have to find reform in it because if you don't, then what is the precedent? What's the next line that we'll cross?
Talk with Matt LaRocca, general manager of Fleischmann Hillard, where his father also works, a former congressman, both of them as lobbyists, although they weren't doing that when father, Mr. LaRocca, was in fact a member of Congress. Let's take a step back here and get a look at this process from an outsider to it. Tony Walker is international editor of the Australian Financial Review. That's a daily business paper. He reports from Washington. And Tony Walker, thanks for joining us.
That's a pleasure.
You're from one of the other Western democracies. How does this look to you?
Well, call me a naive Australian country boy. But from my perspective, I just find it amazing the extent of this industry, the size of it, the dimensions of it, the intrusiveness of it. I defer to Jeffrey Birnbaum's superior knowledge and experience in these matters. But if we take the pharmaceutical industry, for example, as I understand it, since 98, there have been something like 4.5 lobbyists for every congressperson employed by the pharmaceutical industry. And when the pharmaceutical prescription bill was being negotiated through Congress in 2003, lobbyists were actually in congressmen's offices drafting the legislation, helping to draft the legislation. And this is a group of people that is completely unaccountable, and yet they're part of the process. So to me, naive as it may seem to other participants in this discussion, that's just simply amazing.
Hold that thought. Tony Walker, again, international editor of Australian Financial Review. We're going to take a very brief break. A little later on our program on Reporter's Notebook, we'll talk about Israel, apparently now without the leadership of Ariel Sharon. We'll be back, continue this conversation in just a moment on To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. In the context of the Jack Abramoff scandal, we're talking today about lobbying in Washington, a growth industry worth some $2 to $6 billion a year. We've just heard an extraordinary example of it from Tony Walker, who describes himself as a naive Australian country boy, but who is the currently Washington editor of the Australian Financial Review and has given us an example of the pharmaceutical industry with 4.5 lobbyists for every congressional member. in the offices of congresspeople drafting legislation during the Medicare prescription drug bill. What do you think, Tony Walker, was the result of that in terms of the public policy enshrined in that bill?
Well, I mean, I think objectively, and I defy anyone to disagree with this, the bill ended up being extremely favorable to the pharmaceutical industry. I guess they would think the billion or so dollars that they've spent, according to the reports that I've seen, since 1998 on their lobbying activities has been money extremely well spent.
What are some of the other things that you, as a naive Australian country boy, are startled by in this context?
Well, let me just mention one other example, which I just find, you know, frankly astonishing in a country that prides itself on the transparency of its system. When Vice President Cheney was consulting his energy task force in the preparation of an energy bill that ended up being quite favorable to the energy sector, and more favorable, frankly, than some of them had even asked for, the identity of those people advising him was withheld. And the case went to the Supreme Court, as I understand it, and the administration won. I just find that amazing. But, you know, as I said, and as you've pointed out, I'm just a naive Australian country boy, so what would I know?
What does this do for you as far as the image of American democracy and America as a model of democracy is concerned?
Well, I mean, I don't regard, you know, with all due respect to the Americans on this program, as America is necessarily a model. It is in some respects, and I think, you know, we can point to many of the good things about it, you know, an aggressive press and extremely high quality and active media. But there are some aspects that, you know, I find, you know, I find simply amazing. I mean, the money changers, I think you'd have to say, in Washington are well and truly inside the temple.
Tony Walker, again, with the Australian Financial Review. Paul Miller is president of the American League of Lobbyists. He currently works as a lobbyist in Washington with his own firm, Miller Wynhold Capital Strategies. Paul Miller, thanks a lot for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me today.
Let me ask you to respond first to what Tony Walker just said about the presence of lobbyists in the writing of legislation, the extraordinary number that there are just with the pharmaceutical industry alone. He says these are people who are unaccountable and result or their actions lead to policies that are more favorable to the industries involved than they are to the people of the country as a whole. How do you respond to that?
I disagree a little bit. Let me go back to the energy issue that you talked to, that was mentioned as an example.
Sure.
I think that's a clear case that I probably, and I think everybody may agree with, was probably a bad decision on the administration's part not to make those names public. I'm not sure what there was to hide. If there really wasn't anything to hide, why not make that available to the public? So, you know, X, Y, and Z companies were in there helping do that. I'm not sure why the administration felt the need to keep that quiet, unless there possibly was something that was going on there that, you know, most people in the general public wouldn't want to happen. But I think, you know, the Medicare example, again, that there could be some problems there. But I think you have to be very careful because some of these issues are so complex that members of Congress and their staff just can't handle or are not expertise in that area to handle. And they do need the help of lobbyists or folks within those sectors of industry that this legislation is going to help or hurt or impact altogether. So I agree with some of the examples that were given that they seem to be problematic. But I also would not paint everybody in that category as being up to something or no good or corrupt, because these are complex issues at times, and they do need the expertise of people in those industries. And lobbyists just happen to be some of those folks.
Quickly on the Medicare bill, a prescription drug bill, as an example, one of the provisions of it is that the government cannot use its market power with more recipients of medicine than any other entity involved to influence pricing. Everybody can certainly understand that. Is that an example, Paul Miller, of a policy that is more in the interests of the industry than it is the people?
It could be, but I mean, if you take the whole Medicare bill as it is probably something that should be scrapped and redone anyway. I'm not sure that it's the best possible piece of legislation out there, but that is an example of something that could, you know, you could scrutinize.
Let me go back to Jeffrey Birnbaum at the Washington Post, again, author of The Lobbyists, How Influence Peddlers Work Their Way in Washington, and author of many stories in the Washington Post about this. What about the issue of ordinary Americans and whether or not they can get the ear of their representatives? You said everybody listening to this program may have some group or other that is representing him or her in Washington. Do they always even know that?
I don't know if they do or not. But it is fair to say that individuals, individual voters, individual citizens can get the ear of their elected representative, that is, the member of the House who represents them, or sometimes the member of the Senate, though that's a little bit more difficult. It is unlikely that such a person can get the ear of any other voter's representative in the House, or certainly in the Senate. And that's that's where the problem begins, basically. It's certainly a good idea to work with trade associations or organizations that amalgamate lots of people from lots of places, and groups like that can get in to see their elected representatives. But more often, these lawmakers have what you might wisely think of as money constituents, that is, groups that pay them through campaign contributions or give them other favors, a la Jack Abramoff, trips and such, that give those groups access to the members of Congress that individuals just cannot get unless, as we say, they're an actual geographic constituent.
Sure.
And that is the problem. It is the difference between simple democracy and money democracy where the big problem has arisen.
Tony Walker, let me go back to you, international editor of the Australian Financial Review. Does the presence of these kinds of associations and the fact that you can at least get a hold of your congressman if you work at it hard enough mitigate, in your mind, the influence of what are referred to as the money constituents?
Somewhat, and obviously this is a very complicated system and very complicated issues are involved. I hesitate to make these criticisms and observations. I don't want to give undue offense, but I think the American system is so process-driven that there's perhaps an undue requirement for these outside interventions. A question I'd like to pose, actually, and in my research before I came on this program, I noticed that the number of lobbyists, and Jeffrey may have a view about this, during the course of this Bush administration has doubled in Washington to something like 34,000 people, lobbyists, registered. Now, what do all these people do? Why is it necessary? Why have we had this explosion in numbers? And one other point that I would, or question that I would pose is, I think Jeffrey made it seem like the K Street project is a thing of the past. As I understand it, it's ongoing and it's aggressively prosecuted. And I would have thought that's, has undemocratic overtones.
I understand you need to leave us in just a couple of minutes, so I will put those questions to our other guests. You can stay as long as you will. If we can get another response from you, we'll try to do it. But in the meantime, if you can't stay, thanks for joining us.
Again, my pleasure.
Tony Walker with the Australian Financial Review. Let me go to Paul Miller, the president of the American League of Lobbyists. Doubled under the current Bush administration? Why?
I think you have to be skeptical of the numbers that's thrown around, the 34,000 number. If you talk to the folks even at the United States Senate who track this, the numbers, I think they will even agree, are not accurate, because the way this is counted is if you're a woman and you're a lobbyist and you get married, you're counted twice. And if you happen to get divorced a couple times, you may be counted more than twice. If you're deceased,
so divorce is pretty common in Washington among lobbyists.
It really jacks
up the number.
No, I'm just saying if that happens, and also if you're deceased, your number stays on as a registered lobbyist. If you're retired, you stay on the roll, so you're counted. So the numbers aren't accurate. I would put the number probably in the mid 20,000s. 25,000 maybe in that range as far as registered lobbyists here in town.
Okay, but so there are 538 members of Congress. So why are they also necessary? And as Tony Walker put it, what do you all do?
This is information. We provide members of Congress information. There are a lot of complex issues out there, and there's a lot at stake for companies. You have a war in Afghanistan and Iraq going on right now, a lot of rebuilding going on, a lot of government contracts that are worth billions at times. These contracts are important to large companies like EDS and Boeing's of the world. So, yeah, they're going to have top-notch people helping in maneuver that process and helping to ensure that their company is getting some of that money.
Let me go back to Jeffrey Birnbaum with the Washington Post. One thing that I think a lot of citizens want to know is this money fungible? If, for example, we weren't paying for the war or so much for the war in Iraq or for other defense projects, would there be more federal money available to build hospitals, build schools, do other kinds of things that are more immediately beneficial to the citizens of the country?
There's not a clear answer to that question. Theoretically, yes, but then again, the federal government is deficit spending. So another possibility would be to spend into the red, not spend into a deficit. And there are also plenty of other priorities where that other people see as more important than the ones you suggest. For if you are spending less, let's say in Iraq, you could spend more on other things, or even return the money to taxpayers through tax cuts. So it's not as they say, a zero sum game.
Back to Paul Miller with the American League of Lobbyists. To what extent are lobbyists aware of that possible trade-off? Or is your job, like a lawyer arguing in court, to pretty much to represent your client, get the best deal you can?
Well, it is to a degree, but I'm hoping the folks that are, and I know this isn't going to be for everybody, but I'm hoping those who are representing these companies or these corporations, these associations, or whoever are doing it because they also can believe in the issue and that they can go to bed at night sleeping okay. There is probably that line you have to consider. Am I just out here for the paycheck and I know I can get this done, or do I believe in the issue? I think a lot of the folks that I know and I work very closely with are folks who believe in the issues, and that's why they work for the associations or the companies or represent the folks that they do.
Do you think, Paul Miller, that you're going to be subject, you lobbyists, to new and tougher rules simply because of the publicity about Jack Abramoff and whatever consequences there may be from his testimony to the federal investigating authorities?
I think there's a real possibility of that, but I think I need to take a wait-and-see attitude because it's going to depend on how many people Jack touches. I mean, who he's telling the Justice Department who he was involved with. If it's a large number, I heard as many as 60 people today. I would be astonished to see if that was 60 people. But even a handful, I think there's going to be a call for reform. And what we're asking for is before we go and push through some new rules and regulations that may not get everybody where they want to be, let's let the dust settle. Let's let justice do their job, let the court system do their job, and then after that, let's take a look at the current regulations and see what, if anything, needs to be changed. And if there are, why not invite us lobbyists to the table to help you close those loopholes? None of us want to see us on our picture on the front page of the newspaper or any program in Jack Abramoff's situation. So if we can help fix the problems, we're happy to do so, but you got to do it in a fair way. And that means hold public hearings, and debate these issues.
Paul Miller, again, with the American League of Lobbyists. Lobbyists do seem to be at the table, or certainly have been in some pretty dramatic instances of late. Let me go back to Matt LaRocco, the general manager of Fleischmann Hillard Government Relations in Washington, and ask you a question that I hear a lot. I get it in emails from listeners, for example. What's the difference between a campaign contribution to a legislator that does something that your corporation wants him to do, your client wants him or her to do, particularly if they're in the office helping to write the legislation, and a bribe?
Well, I would hate to say that a campaign contribution is that scandalous. It's certainly not a bribe by any means, in my opinion. It is certainly a way to support a member of Congress that you believe is representing the ideologies that you believe in. So I don't think it comes even close to a bribe. I don't think it buys access necessarily. I think that a campaign contribution is, like I said, certainly just support for a member of Congress. Bribes, we've seen this. Members of Congress have had this, problem in the past. There's certainly the Ab scam in the 70s Duke Cunningham from California had to resign because of some scandalous activity that resulted in $2.4 million that he received from defense contractors.
Got a Rolls Royce, among other things.
And he received a fair amount. And so That's obviously goes well beyond the means of just supporting a member because you believe in what he believes in. Obviously, that was favors returned for favors given, and so there's certainly a difference between that.
But you can understand, I assume, how a person from the general public might look at this, whether they're naive Australian country boys like Tony Walker or otherwise, and say, well, if your business is to work on behalf of your client and try to get the best deal you can out of the Congress, and you make a contribution to a congressman's or congresswoman's campaign that helps them to get elected next time out, that looks as if you're paying for whatever that congressperson does. How do you explain that to people who aren't familiar with the subtleties of this process?
Well, I think just the way I just said it, I mean, of course there's members of Congress that we'll give to because we want to see them come back. We want to see them reelected, and those are the members that we support. That's just certainly not a bribe, and even comes close to the definition of it. How do you explain it? The way that I just did, I guess, is
sure.
by explaining the difference between a bribe. I mean, a bribe is truly asking or giving and then asking for something in return, and that's not what we're doing here. We're like I said, we are supporting members of Congress who we want to see return, and those are the ones that we do a lot of work with. But a bribe is so different than a contribution.
Okay. Understand the point. Jeffrey Birnbaum, let me go back to you, give you the last comment on this program. There are all kinds of recommendations floating around about rebuilding the Ethics Committee and changing the leadership of the House, reforming the process in one way or another. Do you think that's likely anytime soon?
Yes. I think that certainly lobbying law changes will probably pass this year as an antidote to what Americans are feeling now, which is a very anti-Washington sentiment stirred by the Abramoff affair. And so we should expect more transparency in lobbying. That is a much greater amount of much more disclosure and a tying together of lobbying and campaign fundraising, which are now separate and confusing and lack a lot of transparency and disclosure. I think that'll be beefed up. In addition, there will probably be some restrictions placed on lobbyists and the extent to which they can interact with lawmakers. There may be more strictures, for example, on foreign travel or travel in general. But that remains to be seen. And
sure.
I think the more lawmakers that are indicted in the wake of the Abramoff plea, the more likely that kind of lobbying, the stronger the new lobbying laws will be.
Well, thanks a lot for being with us. Again, an extraordinarily important subject, a basic to the conduct of democracy in this country. Jeffrey Birnbaum writes the K Street Confidential column for The Washington Post, author of many books on the subject. Thanks to you. Thanks to Matt LaRocco, General Manager, Fleischman Hillard, Government Relations, Tony Walker, International Editor of the Australian Financial Review, and Paul Miller, the President of the American League of Lobbyists. Hope to talk to all of you again soon about this and other subjects as well. Israel's 77-year-old Prime Minister Ariel Sharon was transferred to intensive care today after doctors treated him for a massive stroke. He's not expected to return to power. Vice Premier Ehud Olmert is the interim leader. All this with elections scheduled for March 28th. We'll look at the prospects in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Warman Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Ariel Sharon has been struck down in the midst of leading a new political party into the March elections. We don't want to get ahead of ourselves. Obviously, there are hopes that Mr. Sharon will recover, but it appears that is unlikely, at least that he will be well enough to participate in politics. And given the time frame involved, it doesn't seem inappropriate to talk about what will happen next. With Sharon at the helm, Kadena, the new party that he started, was given a good chance of prevailing over Likud on the right, Labor on the left, and the centrist Shinui Party. Shmuel Sandler is Associate Professor of Political Science at the Bar-Ilan University in Israel. Professor, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Good evening.
How important is Ariel Sharon to Israeli politics?
Oh, yes. The last 5 years, he became a towering figure. He essentially left his mark on Israeli politics. He portrayed an image of a father and veteran leader, and he led Israel through the Second Intifada. And as a result, I think he was very important. So I think we're coming now to end of an era.
The end of an era. You have been quoted as saying that the moment that he goes, meaning the moment that he leaves politics, everything will change. It appears now that he won't be involved in politics again. What changes do you foresee?
Well, first of all, we're going into an election, and with him, there was a chance that we're going to have a plurality party. Without him, we may have three medium-sized parties, which will make it very difficult to form a government. Another thing is we're talking about the whole new generation of leaders like Mr. Olmert and Mr. Netanyahu, even though he was already a prime minister. However, he is going, it's a younger generation, it's not the same generation. So there will be a lot of changes.
What specifically would you think we would see that might be observable from the distance of the United States as a result of the sorts of things you're talking about? If it's difficult, for example, to form a government, what might that mean in a place that is where things are very uncertain?
Yes. First of all, as I said, government, but also there's going to be a lack of a leader with his stature, which Israel needs. It will take a time for a new leader to emerge and establish his credentials. But I think, on the other hand, we saw a very smooth transition of power today. I must say that all the Israeli politicians, the major figures, stood behind Mr. Olmert. And as a result, Israeli politics is going to survive. The only question is when will we have a leader that can make difficult decisions.
Again, Shmuel Sandler is an associate professor of political science at Bar-Ilan University in Israel. Well, what chance do you think, or what are the prospects for Mr. Netanyahu, who, as you indicated, has been a prime minister before? He very unhappy with Mr. Sharon. That's one of the reasons that Mr. Sharon left Likud. Does this put Mr. Netanyahu back in the driver's seat?
Yes, he now has a chance. Beforehand, he didn't have a chance. He has a chance. The main question is, let's say, if Mr. Olmert will be the leader of Kadima and he is elected, with whom would be prepared to form a coalition, with Mr. Netanyahu on the right or with Mr. Peres on the left? At the same time, maybe Netanyahu will gain the plurality position or get the majority, Mr. Netanyahu's party. We don't have a personal direct vote. So everything is now open. And it will be very difficult now to foresee. We didn't see the polls yet, and the polls that are going to come out tomorrow are still going to be very influenced by the sudden event that we're going through. So it will take a few weeks to see where Israeli politics is moving.
What about things that might stay the same? Is there any chance, for example, that there would be, under any of the scenarios that are possible, a major change in Israeli policy with regard to the Palestinians and the settlements and the other issues, the wall between Israel and the Palestinian territories?
I don't think there'll be major changes, even if Mr. Netanyahu comes into power. Essentially, what established the last few years will continue. Mr. Netanyahu also will continue the peace process. Definitely, if it's Mr. Olmert, I don't think this will be the problem. The only main problem will be when it comes up for decisions, then I don't know whether there'll be a lack, there'll be a vacuum of a leader like Mr. Sharaf. Let me just say that we have other problems if you're talking about the peace process, and that is there is a big chaos going on in the Palestinian Authority, which doesn't help the situation. There were supposed to be the elections this month. Nobody knows whether it's going to take place. So this will be also a problem, making it the situation more difficult.
One of the issues there was whether or not Palestinians would be allowed to vote in East Jerusalem, which they very much say they should be able to. There was some indication that Prime Minister Sharon was not going to permit that. What do you think of the prospects for that? And if they can't vote in East Jerusalem, will the Palestinians delay their elections?
This is just we're going to be an excuse for the Palestinians if they want to delay the elections, to hang it, to tie it up as our refusal to let the East Jerusalem Arabs vote. I mean, if they want to have an election, they can have an election. This is not going to stop it. I think the problems are more internal. They are worried about the sweep of the Hamas. So these are the real issues that or the real motivations for a delay which may take place.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today. It was good to have you with us.
Thank you. All the best.
Shmuel Sandler, Associate Professor of Political Science, Bar-Ilan University in Israel. Once again, Ariel Sharon is expected to be sedated for at least the next 3 days as doctors struggle to keep him alive after he suffered a massive stroke. Today's program produced by Francis Anderton with Jonah King and Katie Cooper, Technical Director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.